Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Kids Media Club podcast. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Emily Horgan, and we're very excited to be here with Jo Redfern, our regular co-host, because she's just been traveling again and been somewhere quite exciting. Tell us a bit about your trip, Jo.
Morning. Well, it is morning. It's very early for me. I'm slurping my coffee in case you can hear that. So I'm just fresh back from a trip to San Francisco, my first, which was very cool, to attend GDC, the Game Developers Conference, the annual gathering of, what it appeared to be, everybody from the gaming industry, although I'm sure it was nowhere near everybody from the gaming industry, but a really interesting couple of days there. And the first thing really that struck me was the scale of attendees to GDC. What really, you know, it was huge. When I looked at how many people went to Kidscreen this year, it kind of averaged about 2,200, I think. So, you know, fairly neat. It felt nice and substantial. And then I realized that when I went to GDC, the average attendance there was between 28,000 and 30,000.
Whoa.
Almost 10 times. Oh, yeah. 10 times the number of attendees that you would get at Kidscreen. So the scale was huge. And, you know, you might have read that the gaming industry is a huge industry. I think it's bigger than TV and film, maybe music, but certainly bigger than TV and film. And that really was hammered home just walking around, seeing the sheer number of people that were there. So really fascinating. However, given the massive overlap in the intersection of our two worlds, didn't encounter so many familiar faces that you might have expected would have been there from our side of the fence. So really interesting, lots to download. But did you pick up anything about it? You know, in the course of your days, what did you get? What popped up on your radar?
I suddenly just saw a lot of people on LinkedIn with the arrow going to GDC thing. Which was like a really great FOMO inducer. So that was nice.
Interesting, isn't it? That is a sign of the visual language of the gaming business, that everybody just hopped on and it was an instinctive thing to change your title.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, what I didn't get a sense of was what the talking points might have been from the conference. What were the, because at Kidscreen there were kind of some key talking points that everyone was focused on. What was the focus there at that conference?
Obviously my purview was that specifically with regards to kind of gaming, particularly social gaming, so platforms like Roblox and Fortnite. But, you know, I still I didn't really think I would interact with many mobile game producers, but, you know, we're just in chatting with people. It was interesting to hear about, you know, challenges in mobile gaming, for example, which is still huge, and kind of that hyper casual gaming, that this, you know, IP and IP extension was a really big topic, driven by some of the same headwinds that I guess we're all facing in kids media, in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of layoffs happened in the industry after huge amounts of recruitment over lockdown. So there's a bit of a rebalancing there. We're seeing that. There's similarities there. But what really struck me, and it's probably because the general cohort is much younger, that, you know, rather than there being a sense of panic, there was more a sense of, okay, so we just pivot. We go and do something else. We dust ourselves off rather quickly and we're back on it. So, you know, very entrepreneurial. Obviously, it's a big business in terms of its revenue and financially. So again, what really occurred to me was huge amounts of creativity, and we'll dig into that. But also all of these other businesses that are part of that infrastructure around gaming. There's superstar creators in the gaming industry. There are the equivalents of Mr. Beast that are Roblox developers, and they've got fan bases. They've got groups on Roblox. And so they've got agents. They've got agencies.
Wow. So like a developer will have like an agent.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, they're superstars with big followings in their own right amongst gamers on that platform. So all of those structures that then spring up around those to monetize and to support those were there too. So I met a lot of creatives and developers, but then a lot of ancillary people that were in that business that surrounds gaming, which I hadn't really realized. Well, kind of, you know, if I'd have thought about it, I would have known that they existed and were there, but they were there in number, and it was really, really fascinating to meet them.
That's interesting. And in terms of groups, so you talked about kind of mobile being one group, mobile game developers. Are there kind of identifiable kind of genres within that? So there are people that kind of focus specifically on more of a younger sort of children's market, or because I know I'm quite kind of ignorant of in terms of the landscape of how those kind of groups are identified really within that space.
Yeah, and I would say the same. And I will caveat that I was only there for 2 of the 5 days, so I missed a whole chunk of the conference where the floor was opened up and there were booths and you could walk around. So, you know, had I been there for a little bit longer, I think I would have gone and sought out, you know, the Tokobokas of this world, or the Sago Minis, which, you know, obviously are really prominent and really well regarded in that kids mobile space. But the mobile developers and the people who were in that side of the business that I did speak to, really the headlines were that, you know, mobile is really hard. Cost per download, that customer acquisition cost, is so very hard. So unless you're anything but a really big publisher in mobile, it's a really tricky business to get into. And although, you know, mobile is probably the sector of gaming that stretches oldest and broadest, you know, a lot of older gamers play mobile games. This match three concept, which is, you know, the match three in a row and they disappear, those kind of hyper casual games are big, big business. Clash of the Clans, big, big business. But, you know, again, this idea of IP and IP extension, you know, what constitutes an IP? There is IP that exists within the mobile world. There's also a lot that shouldn't be IP and can't be IP that come from that mobile world, that hyper-casual gaming. But there's this really interesting, you know, I certainly picked up, and I don't know if it's a change or if it's always been there, but game developers now beginning to consider what they do or their properties as IP, and then how do they extend them? Because again, they've got to think about bringing people back to their game and to either download or play or pay some money to, you know, buy some additional content. So this idea of IP extension was something that I spoke about to a lot of people.
And it's that kind of flip between being a developer versus being a marketer. And then somewhere in the middle of that is like the content strategy, and like content strategy as the marketing, the content strategy as the development and as the product. It's such a, where does one start and the other begin? I don't know. And I feel like gaming is really in a tricky place because the platforms for it are not as algorithmically driven. There's not like a YouTube where you can have a shot at building a channel if you invest, you know, you have a decent content plan, you keep consistent and you just plug away and you pivot as you see things happening on a with the gaming. My understanding, and stop me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, you publish on iTunes Store, or not iTunes Store, but the App Store, or even Roblox, and it's kind of like you have that moment where you start, and then building an audience is just so tricky. Like there's no kind of set playbook for building waves that can bring you somewhere.
And I mean, again, it was my first time there, and a lot of it is so very new, so I don't pretend to know the detail, but it did occur to me that, you know, it's still very, you're either a developer for mobile or you're a developer for UEFN and Fortnite, or you are in that kind of Roblox space. And I'm sure there is some transfer between the two in fluidity, but largely you're in a lane, so there's not a huge amount of crossover. But maybe that's, you know, where this idea of IP comes in. You build an IP, you build a franchise, maybe that unlocks the ability to go across platform. But, you know, I think that the differences in platforms are clear. Roblox, huge, popular, social gaming, huge number of users, covers that kind of gamut from very lo-fi, again, kind of casual games, to increasingly complex games on there, and the, you know, the creative and the visuals that you can get on Roblox are advancing all the time. Then you've got Fortnite that tends to attract a slightly older user base. Obviously, the graphics and Unreal engine used there gives you this huge amount of kind of visual, a big visual toolkit. I also believe the developer payouts on Fortnite are more favorable than across Roblox. And then you've got mobile. And then you've got lots of different things in between. You know, it's still web-based games. So lots of different strands of gaming and different concepts and different audiences that occupy each one of those strands and the lanes. But
is there that kind of segmentation of audience, Joe? Like, is it the same where you're like, I'm good, like, so with kids TV, it's like, I'm gonna make a show from, you know, 3 to 7, or, you know what I mean? Is it that targeted, or like gaming kind of mixes it up a little bit because it's more of an inert compulsion maybe than an age thing. Like, talk us through the thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to people who still talked in terms of age bands, but they weren't so focused as we have in kids TV and kids media. You know, the divide really, and it, you know, it's about monetization. That word comes into the conversation a lot earlier than we typically talk about in kids media. So in gaming, the monetization is driven by how old your audience is and how old the audience is on your platform. So really that's the dividing line. Is it under 13 where it's very difficult to monetize?
Okay.
A little bit between 13 and 17 where it opens up, but not fully. And then 17 plus, kind of 18 plus, all bets are off. You know, how can we monetize our gaming audience and users there? So that would be the broad, you know, the kind of the broad brushstrokes of how it's kind of segmented. It's certainly in my first impressions.
Interesting. I was wondering as well, you were saying that there wasn't much of a presence from kids media cohorts at the conference. Did you get a sense that there would be some areas of kids media that would be more likely to attend than others? I was wondering whether, you know, the toy and merchandise side of it might have had more of a presence there than the TV side.
Yeah, yeah, and definitely there was a presence from toy there for sure. You know, what was interesting to me in terms of the opportunity, and yes, there were people from our two worlds there, but I would have perhaps, maybe they were there later after I left, but, you know, I would have expected a big crossover. But this idea of, you know, obviously we know IP can come from anywhere. So it used to come from literary estates and kind of books and graphic novels, comics.
Still does.
Yeah, still does. But obviously this kind of rich mine of potential IP, you know, I would have thought, and there's a huge amount there that, you know, you could potentially look into as potential IP that could extend into content. So in terms of looking for new IP to create content out of, particularly in the context of, we know, you know, obviously the Mario movie did really well, that has gaming origins, you know, The Last of Us. So we're beginning to see now how gaming can be a very, not only rich, but a quality source of storytelling. You know, I think largely there used to be a snobbishness around the thought of creating content for anyone that came from a game, and now that's fallen away. So, you know, but again, huge, you know, what really struck me is some of these game developers, a lot of them don't think they're storytellers, but a few have realized that they are, and they are. They're really clever storytellers. You don't have a Roblox experience that's had billions of visits and has been alive, you know, for 4, 5, 6, 7 years with all of the regular updates that you make, without being a storyteller. And that, for me, is the key takeaway. You speak to these game developers, and I had lots of meetings with them, and I would say, you're inherent storytellers. But what's interesting is, much like that YouTube model where Mr. Beast intimately knows his audience, he knows when they're tuning in, what they like, which parts of his video that they like, that's the same with some of these game developers. They know their user base so very well. They know what stories they're receptive to, and then they deliver them. And it's really fascinating.
I feel like you were there like Joe the Baptist. I baptize you. You are a storyteller. Let's drench you in your audience. Look, you see, arise, a storyteller.
That's amazing. That it also reminded me, as you were describing that, you know, there would have been a time in the 50s where the guys writing for Marvel Comics weren't thinking that they were sitting on IP or that it had any kind of value beyond being something that somebody spent 50 cents for in the newsagents or on kind of the newsstand. Really? And it takes a while for those new industries to I think, have a sense of the IP value beyond, you know, the value that comes out of somebody paying to play the game, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I remember the 50s as well as you do, Andy.
I don't remember it personally, but I'm a big comic book fan, so I'm steeped in the history of that. I mean, interestingly enough, if I wanted to bore you any further with the Marvel thing, Marvel was actually just a bit of an experiment. The actual company that owned Marvel made its money out of the equivalent of kind of whoopee cushions and jokes. And basically they, you know, I think it was the nephew, Stan Lee, needed a job. So they said, well, why don't you do some comics? But yeah, I don't think anyone had any sense of the value of it.
That's fascinating. And maybe there's parallels there. You know, this is, you know, it again, what really struck me, particularly with a lot of the developers on Roblox, is they've, you know, one that I spoke to, you know, their game is 7 years old, which kind of, you know, makes them a very established kind of game on Roblox. But, you know, they've updated it more or less weekly for every week of those 7 years, and they've grown their audience, and now they've got this huge audience, some of which, you know, obviously are aging in and it's new, but the others have stuck with it. So now they've got this, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of visits on a daily basis from a whole group of people that are there to interact with that IP and story. So then that starts, you know, then you start to get a sense of the power for that, you know, the potential power to tell stories and to take that off platform, get into social storytelling, how, you know.
Absolutely.
TikTok, it was clear that TikTok is a massive discovery engine for Roblox experiences. Huge. So again, this flywheel effect that we all talk about all the time is in full effect with
games. Yeah, and that really points to the fact that a lot of these things have value for, you know, the IP or the kind of the story that's being told, but they also have value because connected to that is a whole tribe of fans that will then follow kind of the next iteration or the next spin-off, or if it's turned into a series or a movie, there's assumption that you'll be carrying some of those along with you. And that has an enormous amount of value as well. It reminds me, I saw an interview with a stand-up comedian. He said, going to old media, he said the kind of used to be the networks used to say, you've got talent, we're going to help you find an audience. And he says, now it's, you've got talent and an audience. Can we have your audience, please? And the comedian said, it doesn't sound quite such an appealing deal when you put it like that.
Yeah, so true. So true. You know, that and the knack will be, and you know, it's doable, but the knack is, how do you capture the essence of what keeps that audience coming back and engaging with these games? How do you distill that down into something that then becomes a narrative series or a movie without losing it, to bring that audience across? That's the key, because you know, like I said, they are inherent storytellers, but the way they still tell stories in these games is a very different way to a linear narrative, you know. So you've got to make sure you really distill it down, and that will be the opportunity for storytellers, is finding what is that thing, what is that element, that game loop, that narrative, the characters that keep people coming back to these games, and then how do you transfer that into a story that's going to take that audience with it? But one thing that I thought was really interesting there was, you know, obviously we've got studios that are activating on platforms like Roblox now with established TV and film IP. You've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you've got SpongeBob, you've got, you know, Sonic. What was really interesting was you know, how they're beginning to activate those in Roblox. So of course you can create your world and you've got your characters in it. But how do you then, you know, we've just talked about how you translate IP from gaming into content. Now, what was really interesting is this idea that actually some of the content, iconic content that we might have seen in movies or TV and film, being replicated on Roblox and almost recreated. So you could drop into almost a playable version of your favorite IP, whether it's a movie or a TV series or, you know, an animated series. Drop into an iconic episode, observe it taking part around you, stop, have a playable moment, do something with those characters, and then it moves on. I mean, so wildly kind of the potential is crazy. And of course, Roblox are rolling out these video ads and billboards and almost playable trailers. Really interested to see what they did with Kung Fu Panda 4 in the obby. So all of this stuff, and it's happening at such a pace. That was another thing that was kind of mind-boggling, is how quickly it's happening.
Does the gaming industry think it's happening quickly, or are they like, just this is, we just,
I think this is normal, kind of, yeah.
Business as usual.
Yeah. And so there's this idea that, you know, potentially you could drop into your favorite episode of a TV show and engage with the characters who, you know, it's playing, the narrative's almost playing out around you, and then you could stop and have this playable moment. But then there's, you know, there's other, lots of crazy kind of other things happening too. Like, I noticed obbies, we've spoken about obbies before, a big genre of game on Roblox, but actually the genre is evolving really quickly. So obbies have blown up, been huge, but now this is evolution where one of the big experiences at the moment is obby, but you're on a bike, or obby, but you can't jump. So then the whole genre itself evolves. So
yeah,
it kind of makes your head spin just how quickly the whole platform reinvents itself.
Yeah, yeah. I was having this discussion with somebody earlier about the, what's a format and what's a genre? What a genre, like the genre is oppy, the format, like it's just, that's an interesting thing to consider in numerous different elements.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. It's probably the best way to look at it, or the most one that, you know, is the way of looking at it that we're most familiar with.
Yeah, but, and then it's also like, what, like, there's probably genres that haven't been invented, game genres that haven't been invented yet on Roblox. So I kind of think of like, fails were so big on YouTube for ages, but actually wins, you know what I mean? Like, that, what's the opposite of an obby kind of thing? Like, so yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it all pans out.
Yeah. And the other big thing to kind of download, you know, just expanding on that. So now we've got whole storefronts that aren't really kind of what you would class as a typical game on Roblox, because obviously your avatar, a huge number of people will change how their avatar looks, and particularly amongst younger cohorts, that gets into kind of the 60-70% of those cohorts that are on Roblox daily will update their avatar daily, if not multiple times a day. So that this idea of kind of visual identity and digital merch, again, badging, wearing something relating to your favorite game, your favorite character, your favorite IP, your favorite musician, is alive and well. So now you've got the emergence of basically stores, digital stores on there, where you can go in, you can walk around Adidas, you can go, you know, choose yourself a new football shirt, or you can go into the marketplace, and there are wildly creative, you know, just game designers whose whole job is just to design items for avatars and upload them to the, you know, marketplace, and they are making a very good living out of just designing stuff for avatars. They're not even in the game development business per se. They're digital designers, just creating
digital fashion designers.
Merch. Yeah, yeah, and accessories. Hair is massive on the platform at the moment. Changing your hairstyle, new and elaborate hairstyles. And trends where people are following.
I could get into that, changing the hairstyles. I see the appeal here.
But yeah, I mean, given that you know, in 12-18 months time, commerce is being unlocked on the platform, then you know, I was chatting with Stephen DiPianco, who you might you know, see, he's got a really interesting newsletter on LinkedIn about primarily about Roblox. You know, backpacks, accessories for your avatar, they go through huge kind of trends too. But very soon, you, if you really like one, click, it'll be in your basket. So, you know, that unlocks, you know, for those of us who've worked in that merchandise world, and you obviously, you know, that's a big, big revenue stream, that is going to open up in 12 months' time, so on the platform as well.
And what's the kind of price point for a player of these kinds of things, like Robux? And then, you know, it feels like it's hyper casual consumption. It's like quite disposable. Yeah. I don't know. Is it costing them 50p? Like, what's the starting point?
Oh,
and
yeah.
It can be pence. Yeah. So it's like, it's kind of disposable in that sense. And then do you
get a
sense
unlimited.
Of? Yeah. Yeah.
So you can have items that cost 5 Robux. And that's literally pence. You know, it can be a new shirt. It's something that someone's designed and uploaded. But then you can go up to, I was talking about Ajax, who'd put an official football shirt on the platform this week. That was 95 Robux. I think that works out at $1.30 something. And then you've got limited items, again, that are, there's an element of scarcity. So, and then if they're trend driven, there are marketplaces for reselling and these things. So again, then you get the odd thing that really goes crazy in price. You know, a certain headgear that everybody wants. And I think I read one that went for $15,000.
Oh my gosh.
So
crazy.
So again, that whole marketplace and commerce element is alive and well, all on this one platform where you can play, you can hang out, you can trade, you can now watch video. Soon you're going to be able to buy through the platform. I mean, the mind boggles at the power in the ecosystem that Roblox is.
And does it in that kind of transactional element, or like, what's the rev share with the designer, or is it that simple?
I don't know, but yeah. I do know that people are making a nice living, thank you very much, off it. It's fascinating. And probably the final thing that I can kind of think to kind of download is, you know, activating on the platform is a question that I get asked a lot. You know, surely it's cost prohibitive. What are the things that we need to bear in mind? And it can be cost prohibitive. It depends. You can get an experience away relatively cheaply, but much like we've often said with YouTube, you wouldn't go onto YouTube without a 12-month plan of content and some media to start boosting that content and get it off and running in the first place. I'd say it's more or less the same on Roblox. It's not a one and done, particularly not if you're in that IP-driven storytelling business. If you're on there, you're on there for the duration, so you've got to plan accordingly. But similarly, you know, integrations, you hear a lot about that. Again, I met several agents and agencies that are there representing experiences on the platform, often exclusively, saying, right, you know, talk to me if you want to do an integration. So, you know, the advantages of an integration being you don't have to build and own your own experience on the platform. You can drop in for 8 weeks and you can almost rent the audience of that experience. And as long as you've matched it to your IP, hopefully you pick up some new audience.
Learnings as well, that like it's a light way or a diet way of getting in. And I think like similar with YouTube, right? There's like, you can go straight ad spend and that's as big as your budget. You can go into more of like influencer or integration, that kind of thing. And you don't own that forever, but you'll be able to see the analytics, see what the kind of stickiness is, versus then obviously going for the trying to own your own presence there.
Yeah.
But yes, one does not simply put things on Roblox or YouTube.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, that integration option is also viable for IP owners as well. You know, it doesn't have to be something that is an activation by a big consumer brand. It could be by an IP. It could be that you drop your characters into there, see how they're how they're received, or you know, kind of tell a little story on there, and again use it as a test bed, use it for information, for data, and then take that away. You know, if there's it's a toe dip, And that's, you know, it's a viable toe dip. It's not just an integration to try and bring in revenue. Actually, it can be a very valuable toe dip that gives you lots of information about your IP and how you might then want to activate it subsequently.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was super interesting too.
That's amazing. Mm. I feel like there's loads of stuff to process and just take in.
Yeah, lots. But yeah, really interesting and, you know, worth, if you can ever go and immerse and just kind of swim around in that world and, yes, you know, come away like I did with mind-boggling and trying to process what the opportunities might be. But, yeah, really good experience. Really enjoyed it. But we've got heaps more to talk about. Yeah. Lots.
I mean, one of the things that you mentioned when you were talking about the developers conference is about the ability for people to really build their own tribe of fans and how powerful that ends up being from kind of a business point of view. And we've got two YouTube stars that are kind of really kind of moving out of their lane and potentially taking their tribe of fans with them. And one is Mr. Beast and the other one is Ryan's World. Yeah. I don't know that much about Ryan's World. Can anyone here fill me in and kind of explain what's going on?
Yeah, well, Ryan's World has been like a super established YouTuber, kidfluencer, it was used to be called, for a number of years and has been building. I feel like he was probably the first one to really break out. He's
started an unboxing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's based out of America, and he was one of the main. He was like the Coco Melon for Pocket Watch. Pocket Watch is a YouTube a studio that runs that looks for these gems in YouTube from a kid's perspective and helps them monetize in different ways and usually lots of the ways that we would have traditionally monetized. So looking at licensing deals, looking at onward distribution, all that kind of stuff. And he was kind of like, Ryan is kind of like the Coco Melon of Pocket Watch. He has a show. He's a show on Nick Jr. They did a show with him, live action and animation, I think. He's been around for many years. I'm nearly like, how old is he at this stage? Because, you know, it feels like Ryan Kaji has been something I've been talking about for quits of a decade at least.
I was just going to say, surely he's 35 by now, but he's only 12.
He's 12. Based out of Texas. Wow. But I feel like he's been really big for probably since he was about four.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been vaguely aware of the unboxing side of it and the kind of the toy aspect of it, but I never really, I'm not very familiar with him as a brand, really.
Yeah, the big in the States.
I saw him at licensing show a good 5-6 years ago.
And I feel like a big in the US, I think that's maybe one of the things about the live act, like, you know, being an in-person influencer is, you know, there can be a real following in a particular country or whatever. So like Ryan's World, he'd be cohorts and Kids Eye on a Show is the other one on Pocket Watch and like Nastya as well. Yeah. But Ryan is definitely the biggest and the OG. So he's just releasing a movie himself in 2000 cinemas basically in the US, so no big deal.
As you do.
It's amazing. Like Ryan's World, a movie, Titan Universe Adventure, is going to 2000 screens in the US. Lucas Shaw's newsletter from Bloomberg Screen Time, which is definitely worth signing up to, because if you sign up to it, you get it for free in your inbox. Whereas if you try to access it, you need to sometimes have a subscription to Bloomberg. So covered it last Monday, or was Sunday, I think he released, but doesn't hit my I don't wake up and read until Monday morning typically. It's following the Taylor Swift approach as well, right? So
who's going with the distributor. Ryan's World and Taylor Swift were going to be mentioned in the same sentence.
Not Taylor Swift. So like it's going without a distributor, which is punchy, you know. Obviously, you don't have the benefit of the marketing, the same marketing machine. Obviously, Ryan's World has a huge following, and the Pocket Watch network of channels has, I think, over a billion views or a billion subscribers. So
and don't they both in some way subscribe to that stand-up comedian's point that hang on a minute, I've got the content, the talent and the fan base, what do I need the studios for?
Of course.
yeah Yeah, yeah. And I think it's all about then the economics of it working, right? So with Taylor Swift's movie, I feel like I think it was something like 15 million that was invested in the production. Because it was, obviously done really well. And then, for a concert movie. And then at that stage, a 15 million budget for a movie is not, it's nothing really. And so, if you make 100 million in box office, you're away in a hack. If you make more than that, then that's obviously, you continue on your hack to a very comfortable place of financial freedom. But
it's a good point because, obviously Ryan, sorry to interrupt, Emily, Ryan, he's an established content creator. And so, the fact that they've made a movie, I'm assuming, hasn't required the $100 million investment that a Hollywood one would. It's a mixture of animation. He's got that animated series, Red Titan. That's the animated version of Ryan. But then obviously I believe it's kind of a mixture of live action and that. So it doesn't feel like the investment in the production of it is going to be that high. So then that starts making sense economics-wise in terms of going direct to those cinema chains and saying, okay, we've got this movie. Like you say, it feels like it's going to wash its face relatively easily, provided they can convert that audience that is following the IP on YouTube to ticket buyers and ones that will go to the theater. But I can't see why they wouldn't.
Yeah, I can see it working. And I can see it being there being a lot of upside for the cinema chains as well, because potentially you're bringing into the cinema an audience that aren't habitually going to the cinema. So, you might be getting a kind of a new audience there.
Yeah, and I feel there was a feeling in cinemas this year that, kids' stock of kids' movies was maybe a bit lighter than before from the writer's strike, from obviously the economics. So this is a new way of doing that. 2,000 screens is a punchy call though, right? Like that's not like a little Netflixy kind of like we'll just put it somewhere and it'll be fine. That's quite a few cinemas. So if it works, it'll be great.
To state
a truism.
It could fall on its face. But if it worked, it may change the way people approach that question as well about cinema.
Definitely going to be a lot of eyes on it for sure. And but it's an August release, I think. It's summer. Typically, we're going to see lots of kids and families going to the cinema at that time of year. And back to your point about, and the same one with Taylor Swift, cutting out the middleman, The marketing that those middlemen brought used to be the thing that made or broke a release. But now, given that they've got, again, back to this point, they've got a direct relationship with their fans. They know them better than a distributor's marketing team. So almost, it makes sense. We'll have a direct conversation with you. We'll tell you we've made a movie and it's going to be available in theaters.
Yeah.
We'll take control of our own messaging and marketing because, after all, we know you better than anybody else. And, here we are. We've served it to you. So, it really makes a lot of sense. So, I think, Taylor Swift's done it. Ryan's done it.
They are the biggest of the big, though.
Come thereafter. Yeah.
Yeah, but they are the biggest of the big is what I'd say. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not something that you would do lightly, because movies take marketing generally. So, and they are, Taylor's obviously top of her game right now.
Yeah.
Ryan is the leader of the pack in terms of that live action. No, it's not live action, but that kind of that influencer, you kept influencer kind of.
We're not advising anyone with 12 followers on YouTube makes a pitch for their own movie.
You're not going to see the Kids Media Podcast a movie coming to cinemas anytime soon.
Oh, I don't know. Let's say that. Come on.
And talking of another YouTuber that's leveraging his fan base in another era, there's Mr. Beast as well, isn't there?
$5 million deal rumored with Amazon. Was it $5 million or is $5 million the prize pot?
It's $100 million.
It's $100 million. It's $5 million.
$5 million is the prize.
Yes. Okay.
I would have thought Mr. Beast won't get out of bed for $5 million when you're saying that.
I'm thinking of the game show. Yeah, and I think 1,000 contestants. I heard rumors of yeah, and this prize pot of $5 million, which sounds like one of the biggest game shows that I can think of in recent times.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting one, you know, and I mean, Amazon is just such a mixed bag. Amazon as a streaming service is just such a mixed bag of things. But maybe in a way that works because it's not like a really specifically curated, like bringing more people on is it's definitely going to be a benefit for them. They'll, you know, they'll be able to monetize them in other ways and all that kind of stuff. It's a new audience. It's that younger, I feel like it's that younger audience, you know what I mean? That,
yeah,
that are like used to buying things on that, like on Amazon. So yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, I think Amazon suffers a bit from people discovering shows on Amazon. You imagine that a Mr. Beast game show on Netflix would blow up in a way that maybe it's more difficult for it to do on Amazon.
It will be interesting to see what kind of monetization strategy surrounds it as well on the platform.
Yeah.
That, you know, is there going to be an equivalent of Black Friday run by Amazon, an event around the Mr. Beast game show? I'm going to say there is. But similarly, you know, again, is it a tacit acknowledgement that platforms like Amazon don't really know how to reach that audience? So, you know, we don't know, so we'll have your expertise in doing it. Thank you very much.
I mean, and actually one thing that your point kind of made me think about is that I'm assuming there's a big advertising advantage to Amazon as well in some respects, because surely Mr. Beast will be hammering and promoting the show on his YouTube channels.
And listen, YouTube just continues to like pull in, it continuously pulling ground from the streamers, right? Like it's been, I think we talked about this recently, about, you know, it's in the US, it's been top of the streaming services for like give or take the last year.
Yeah.
It's more and more prevalent on connected TVs. I know, Joe, you shared a post about that recently with a great article. It's trying to capture that, you know, it's trying to capture some of that back over, which I think they do need to be doing, because there's this kind of sense of people used to age out of social and maybe even age out of gaming and like age out of those kind of lo-fi video and entertainment formats. Mm. But I think the question is that going to continue to happen or not, you know? And there's lots of different thoughts on that, obviously.
Yeah, I can, you know, I really do see this launch being a huge event. I'm really quite excited, but to see what they do around it, I think it will be massive, because, you know, like I said, a platform, an Amazon takeover is you can imagine that it's going to be all about Mr. Beast when that show launches.
The thing I've never really seen Amazon do brilliantly is to have a brand, like a brand, an IP, content IP that they've majorly managed to flip from a merchandise and sales point of view. Like, you know, sports they had for a while, but like I just never really got a sense that they managed to majorly capitalize on that. And same with kids IP, it's like it's such an obvious thing. You have the storefront, loads of people are Prime users, pretty much everybody in all the major markets shops on Amazon regularly. Like, I don't know, that one's always been a bit of a head scratcher for me. So I mean, if anyone can think of a good example of it, please hit me up, because I've been kind of scratching around looking for that synergy, because it seems so obvious.
Yeah, it does. Well, maybe this is the one.
Good. Awesome. Well, this has been loads of fun, guys. It's always good to just chin wag with you two.
Good to chew.
It was great. And really fascinating to hear about the developers conference.
I mean, I'm going to try and corral a few more thoughts together and maybe do a few posts on it, but really, you know, it was really fascinating. Lots of opportunity. Yeah, this whole idea of kind of social storytelling, you know, if it comes from an IP within kids media, this idea that actually, you know, you just go on Roblox and you create an experience, I think, you know, there's so much more, there's so many other ways that you could activate on the platform that are more sophisticated than that and actually more cost effective. You know, again, I come back to that. People think, oh, it's out of my league. We can't do anything on Roblox. But actually, there are really small ways that you can test and learn and you can activate on there. So don't summarily dismiss it. You just got to figure out what that particular activation for your brand would be. So yeah, lots more to come on that.
Fantastic. I think that's as good a place as any to end it. So thanks very much. Hope you guys have enjoyed listening to the episode. Please follow, subscribe, and all of those shenanigans. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.